solve large, intractable problems.
It's a new venture altogether.
Your brain is a wild horse there.
Because remember, writing is not a team sport.
You are not selling horse carriages when there are cars.
I want to be known only as a trusted advisor.
More like a tourist.
Play to Potential Podcast.
Hello, listeners. Welcome to the next episode of Connecting the Dots. This is the 10th such episode we are doing of Connecting the Dots. Here, rather than bringing in a new guest, we take a theme and cull out insights gleaned at the podcast over the years, and I try to bring in my perspectives along the way as well. Some of the themes around which we've connected the dots include self-awareness, the art of listening, identity, breathing life into work, habits, resilience, judgment, and parenting. This one is on journaling. Now, why did I pick journaling as a topic? There are a couple of things I've observed about journaling, a couple of contrasting things, I should say. On one hand, I've seen many accomplished leaders speak about journaling as something that's really helped them in some way or the other in terms of harnessing their potential. On the other hand, I've seen many people who want to embark on the journey but don't know where to start. This podcast is for the latter. Let's learn a little bit more about the various ways in which journaling could be used and try and apply it in the best way possible for our lives. In this episode, we speak about why journaling is beneficial and the science behind it. We look at the different purposes it serves, ranging from reducing negative chatter in our brain to analyzing our lives, to improving our judgment, to developing restraint in the moment, to processing complexity around us. I'm sure there are many more applications, but these are just a few that we cover in this conversation. We then move to the how of journaling and explore a few different ways in which we should and should not approach journaling, including some wisdom from Jim Collins, the legendary author. First, let's look at the why of journaling. Of the various pieces of commentary around journaling, the most intuitive insight comes from Rich Fernandez. He was the CEO of Search Inside Yourself Leadership Institute, a leadership development organization that was incubated in Google many years back. He says that journaling is a bit like running an operating system upgrade on ourselves.
When you journal, you're basically capturing and encoding your thoughts about a specific situation rather than letting them basically fester, to use a very untechnical term. And so when you are doing this very concrete exercise of stating how you feel, stating what you hope for, stating your goals, you are really making them very, very clear in your own mind. And I think it really helps navigate towards those positive outcomes. One thing we know also, another bit of neuroscience, is that what they found is that people have a better memory for things they've written down than that which they've typed in a classroom setting. That's been a finding in neuroscience. And what neuroscientists have found is the reason for that is that because we can type faster than we can write longhand. And we could type almost at the speed of what's being spoken. And so basically what we're doing is we're just essentially quickly processing but not encoding what's being said, okay? And when you write something longhand, like when you journal, you actually have to articulate entire thoughts in your head and they become encoded in your memory in a much stronger fashion. And so basically, you're programming yourself in another sense of the word when you journal. You're programming your brain to perceive a situation, you know, through a certain lens or perspective, and it becomes much more real and concrete. And in some ways, you start to live your way into that, if that makes any sense.
I love what Rich says about writing longhand versus typing. Reminded me of a very interesting nuance that I hadn't paid attention to earlier. I recently bought the Remarkable 2. For those of you that don't know what it is, it's a digital writing notebook where you can take notes on meetings and organize them digitally. It's like a writing feature in an iPad without the distraction of an iPad. With two young kids, I would willingly pay a premium to not have the apps and features that an iPad possibly has. When I was trying to understand the difference between writing on an iPad or any other tablet versus Remarkable, one of my friends mentioned that the core experience of writing is actually the friction between the pen and paper. And when you take that away, it's like writing on glass. It's smooth, but it's not quite the same. If I stretch this idea further, it's possibly the friction that drives the encoding in the memory. I know it is convenient to type, but I found that there's something to the habit of putting pen on paper, even if it's a digital pen on paper, as long as there's friction. Remarkable, that way, has given me a hybrid option where I can have the pen and the typing interface when I want. While Rich speaks about the idea of an operating system upgrade, journaling can be useful in many other contexts. Let's look at some of them. The first one that comes to mind is just sometimes calming down the monkey mind that can go on in a hyperdrive very often. It can do that by creating a distance between the experience and us and give us the ability to look at things a little more dispassionately as an audience watching the movie rather than being consumed as a character in the movie.
There is some research, this is some work that we've done in our lab, that has looked at links between journaling and distancing. One of the interesting things about writing about your own life is that you become the character in a story. So an author is actually writing about a character, but the character is you. So there does seem to be a distancing function that expressive writing has. You know, you're almost stepping back and writing about your own life, and there is a distancing feature associated with that.
The idea of creating a distance and being an observer is an interesting one. Another application of this is something as simple as tally marks. It's not quite journaling in the purest sense of the word, but the act of putting pen on paper and getting in touch with ourselves and creating some distance between the event and us. Moving to the audience seat from being on stage. Neeraj Agarwal, a dear friend, batchmate at IIM Ahmedabad, until recently, Asia-Pacific head of Boston Consulting Group, speaks about this practice that has really helped him add a time delay function and move from reacting to responding with a pause.
Earlier, I used to be too in the moment. So I would have an emotion and I would express it. I've learned to add maybe a 15-second or a 1-minute time lag to my emotion. I think it's a acquired skill, but that allows me now to not hit the highs and the lows that much. I feel nothing is reason to feel that good or nothing is reason to feel that bad. If you just add a little bit of time lag to my emotion.
And can you talk about the how, if I may stay with that?
It's just training of your mind to say, like, whatever emotion is, just add a delay function to it. You know, it's just, I don't have more to it, but it's a mental training to say, like, early on, okay, here's how I trained my mind, actually, now that I remember it. Early on, if there was an emotion, I would do a tally mark at the back of my note.
Wow.
So in a meeting, I would have 20 tally marks. So I got it down to 10, to 5, and then I got it down to 0. I just trained my mind to... So every time I had an emotion, particularly negative emotion, I would add a tally mark.
And is there any particular emotion or in general when you have a volatility or a surge?
Yeah, a surge of emotion. Particularly when I disagreed strongly, I would add a tally mark. So like, you know, sometimes, you know, the best way to, and I would, in the past when I had a disagreement, sometimes I'd be sharp in my rebuttal. But now I sometimes feel just making a joke out of it. Sometimes just having a smile and, you know, making the person realize the idiosyncrasy of what they are saying, you know, is just sometimes better, right?
And the message in a softer.
Yeah, exactly. So I think that's been an, I wish I had the skill earlier in life, but I really enjoyed acquiring that skill.
If calming the mind and creating some distance between the event and us is the first broad application, the second broad application I have seen is to move us towards a more positive outlook. Very often, we end up weighting the negatives in our life much more than the positives. And these are situations where some sort of gratitude journaling can help. To put it simply, gratitude journaling is a practice of regularly recording positive aspects of life to boost mental health and happiness. Often by listing three or more things that you're thankful for each day. This habit helps rewire the brain to notice positive experiences, reduces stress, and fosters resilience by getting you to focus on what's going well rather than what's going wrong. If you have a couple of minutes, I would urge you to go to YouTube and look for Do It Jones. He's given a lovely speech titled Celebrate What Is Right With The World. Do It Jones is a National Geographic photographer, and in this talk, he talks about how the frame is a function of our state of mind. In any situation, there are many things going wrong in the frame, but he says that over time, he's cultivated the habit of looking for what is right in the frame and shoot it. And gratitude journaling is one way to make it as a practice. In this context, I love what Daniel Pink says about how the mind works. He speaks about a fascinating piece of research about how the mind of silver medalists and bronze medalists work. He speaks about the notion of counterfactual thinking.
So this is some really interesting research started. Actually, the initial research on this came out in 1992, so it's 30 years ago. At the Barcelona Olympics, Tom Gilovich at Cornell and Vicky Medvec, now at Northwestern, then at Cornell, did some really interesting research. And what they did is that they showed, as you say, the photographs of Olympians at the medal stand, and what it showed is exactly what you said. Gold medalists are ecstatic, bronze medalists are really happy, and silver medalists aren't that happy, even though they got the silver medal at the Olympics. And so the reason has to do with, again, our incredible brains. Our brains are, the more I write about behavior and brains, the more I'm just in awe of what our brains can do. I mean, it's extraordinary what our brains can do. It's extraordinary. And one of the things our brains can do is something known as counterfactual thinking. That is, we can imagine scenarios that run counter to the facts. And there are two kinds of counterfactual thinking. One of them is called, one of them is a downward counterfactual, where you imagine how things could have gone worse. And so I don't like downward counterfactual. It's too complicated. I like to call it an at least. And so the bronze medalists are like, oh, at least I got a bronze medalist rather than the schmo who finished fourth. He doesn't have any medal at all. So they imagine. So here's the thing, at least make us feel better. And that's okay. That's actually a psychological, that can be a healthy way of doing things, a healthy way of interpreting events. The silver medalist is saying, if only I had kicked a little harder in the final turn, I'd have won the 100-meter freestyle race. And that's an upward counterfactual. If onlys make us feel worse, but they make us do better. And so this is another way of understanding. And so regret is the quintessential upward counterfactual. It can help us do better. It makes us feel worse and helps us do better. It helps us do better because it makes us feel worse.
So from a performance perspective, Dan, just building on what you just said, how do you work with these two, right? At some level, in a way you're saying we need to have some sort of a switch that flips. You know, when we are practicing, some sort of upward counterfactual is helpful. But once the results are out, it helps to take the other view. So do you have a view on how we play on this?
It depends. Okay, so here's the thing. Let's see if we can figure out a career example here, which might be more relevant. So let's say that, so here we go. So let's say that somebody, we'll call them Vishal, all right? So let's say Vishal takes a job. It's a childhood friend of one of my kids, all right? So let's say Vishal takes a job and it is and he hates it. It's terrible. It's a terrible job. He really doesn't like it. Okay. And he realizes that he made some mistakes in even taking the job. It wasn't that there were warning signs ahead of time. Okay. So he's feeling regret about that. Now, what can Vishal do about that? So let's say that, so what Vishal can do about that is say, you know, if only I had done more due diligence ahead of time and researched this company a little bit more, if only I had talked to three people who were in this position beforehand, I would not have made this choice. Okay. And he can take those lessons and carry them forward and looking for his next job, knowing now that he has to do some due diligence, that he has to find surrogates for that kind of job, that he has to maybe talk to his mentor. Maybe he didn't talk to his mentor to get some advice on that. Okay. So it's like, okay, I really messed up here. Now that feels bad. He can make himself feel, he can still get that instruction and mitigate some of the pain, not all of it, by saying, but at least I got paid decently, so I'm not in the hole. And so you can do both. Now, if he were simply to say, at least I'm getting paid decently, he's not going to change. He's going to be stuck in that bad situation. So it's possible to do, it's possible to do, and if only without an at least, but sometimes if you're willing to take the pain of the if only, as Vishal just did, you can mitigate some of the pain with an at least.
Got it. And is the at least the sort of the conceptual point there similar to the notion of gratitude, having gratitude for what we have?
That's interesting. That's a really interesting way to put it. I'm not sure. I never thought about it that way, but I think that's a really nice way to put it. My hunch is that they're probably adjacent or connected in the roots or somewhere. That's a great point. I never thought about that, but it probably is. At least are a way to essentially recontextualize your situation in order to make yourself feel better. But the problem is with at least, and that's okay sometimes. The problem is that at least don't help you do better. At least confer zero performance benefit. They mitigate some pain, and mitigating pain is cool, but they don't offer any instruction.
The way I see it, the mind often moves to an if-only frame by default. If we can gently nudge it to an at-least frame without losing the performance benefit of if-only, I think that's a good place to be. There are three broad pieces of guidance I give to people that are considering gratitude journaling. First, is to be specific rather than vague. Second, is to focus on people in your life, not just things you have. Third, is going deep on a few topics rather than a long, shallow list of items. This is specifically helpful if you have a glass half-empty type default setting in your life. Oprah Winfrey, for example, is known to have used gratitude journals quite a bit in her life. The third broad application of journaling, I feel, is in just building internal self-awareness. This is a term I learned from Tasha Urich. She says that there's internal self-awareness, which is how we see ourselves, and external self-awareness, which is how the world sees us. And journaling is a great way to build internal self-awareness. When I work with a leader, I normally look at the self-awareness of the leader as a tripod. One leg is gathering feedback from the world around them, their colleagues, people in the ecosystem they interact with, friends, family such as spouse, sibling, and so on. Second leg is internal self-awareness, where I try to give them a journaling prompt every week or so, and they marinate in the questions. And the third leg is often the psychometric, which is often the equivalent of a blood test in a health checkup. These three legs give a sense of triangulation when we think about self-awareness. But back to internal self-awareness, I do feel journaling is a wonderful way for us to get to know our beliefs, our values, our triggers, and much, much more. In this context, I'm excited to launch the second edition of the journal, Crafting a Full Life, this time with a premium leather cover, a high-quality sleeve that will remind you of an old VCR cassette, fine-stitched detailing, and much more. This journal takes you on a year-long 52-week journey, helping you get in touch with various facets of yourself, including your values, principles, superpowers, triggers, and other aspects of your life, and help you craft a life of joy and meaning. Do consider investing in yourself or gifting your friends or family or colleagues. You can find the details at playtopotential.com www.ai.ai.com/journal. Coming back, we've looked at three applications so far: distancing, gratitude, and internal self-awareness. The fourth application, I would say, is broadly in the realm of self-development, really bringing intentionality to something we want to get better at. For instance, Sir Andrew Leekyaman, a professor at London Business School and an expert on judgment, speaks about how we all can improve our judgment by keeping a scorecard and reflecting at a certain frequency.
I've got an example from commercial life, or rather, it's somebody who's involved in a government department here, who said at the end of every week, she sat down and wrote down the major decision she'd made in the week. And this was before we hadn't, I mean, she hadn't read anything that I'd written, is it? That, and I, but I happened to be talking to her, and that, she gave me this example. And she reflected at the end of the week. It just took, she said, about 15 minutes to say, all right, so what did I do then? And how did it go? And do I regret that? Now, she said, all right, end of the week is a bit short term. You haven't got the answers, but at least it gives you some way to look back on that.
The fifth application I would like to bring your attention to is in the context of processing the complexity around you. As they say, it is lonely at the top. Having a journal and a writing habit can help you pause and soak in the nuance of the complexity around you. A wonderful example of this comes from the practice of our former Prime Minister, Narasimha Rao. His biographer, Vinay Sethupathi, speaks about how Narasimha Rao kept a diary and how it helped him sift the signal from the noise.
He was a lonely guy. So what does he do in the evenings, right? He keeps a diary. And he didn't have too many friends. So the diary, like, you know, Anne Frank's diary was, you know, fundamentally a diary that you're talking in the absence of a friend, right? But luckily for him, he was lonely from childhood. So then when he reaches the top in politics, when everybody is lonely, he's pretty used to it. So he's not worried at that point, right? Because he's prepared for loneliness all his life. But I think the diary was a way in which he could be true to himself, because a lot of politicians get fooled by, especially when they're in power, get fooled by the world around them, are unable to tell flattery from the truth. And Narasimha Rao's ability to be introspective, to be inward, helped him sift the day into what, you know, or to put it in statistical terms, to be able to sift the signal from the noise. So I think that's the first thing that introspection taught him, that, you know, one is it taught him don't trust anyone except your diary, which is a pretty good skill in politics. Second is that you should be able to sift the signal from the noise, you know. Who are the people you met every day? You know, how many people are being honest? How many people are lying? You know, to give you just one example, you know, one of the diary entries which I have in the book is from 22nd May 1991. Right? This is the day after Rajiv Gandhi has been killed near Chennai. And Narasimha Rao, who until then had been basically eased out of the Congress and was about to become a monk in a monastery called Kottralam in Tamil Nadu and was closing his bank accounts, is suddenly realizing that by virtue of being the least ambitious man in the party, he's primed to be Prime Minister of India, right? And the diary shows, 22nd May, he's back in Delhi. He's in 10 Janpath, where Sonia Gandhi and Rajiv used to live. And, you know, pieces of Rajiv Gandhi's body, they're just pieces, they're not the full body, are kept there. And all the congressmen are around the body pretending to cry, some of them actually crying, while actually trying to maneuver to see who would succeed him. And he has this wonderful passage about how Pranab Mukherjee, who was in the boondocks then, but would later recover to become president of India, wheedles up to him and says, we think you should become Prime Minister, Congress President, which is the proxy for Prime Minister of India. And Narasimha Rao immediately says, I immediately told him that, you know, that it was, you know, that I'm not the right person, right? Knowing full well the kind of person he is. I also gave him the name of N.D. Tiwari for Prime Minister of India, knowing that he was even less likely a candidate than I am, right? And I think the introspection and the diary allows him to do that. It allows him to reflect over the day. You know, otherwise, you know, think of it. Somebody else come, you know, Pranab Mukherjee came up to me and said, maybe you should be Prime Minister of India. I won't stop to ask what's his angle, right? So I think the introspection gave him that ability. I think the third thing introspection gave him was to take the long view. You know, often we're so caught up in the moment that we're unable to, you know, to see short-term benefit from long-term, long-term costs. We're unable to separate that.
Several people are known to have been avid journalers. Da Vinci, Marcus Aurelius, Mahatma Gandhi, Winston Churchill, Benjamin Franklin, Bill Gates, Warren Buffett, Richard Branson, and many more. Distancing, gratitude, internal self-awareness, deliberate development, and processing complexity are just five of the many applications of journaling that I've come across. I'm sure there are many, many more situations where I can imagine it being helpful. But hope this gives you a flavor of what's possible when you get into a journaling habit. But the broad point I want to make is journaling is good, it's useful, and it's transformational. Let's now turn our lens towards the how of journaling, now that we've established that it's a great idea. What are the do's? What are the don'ts? When do we write? Is there a time in the day that works, and so on? The first point around the how of journaling is to get the tone right. You need to observe things the way they are and not be too judgmental about yourself in the way you go about it. Without us realizing, we all can suddenly become too hard on ourselves in the way we see a situation. It's critical for us to see journaling as a pathway to developing non-judgmental self-awareness. And this distinction is crucial. Rajiv Vij, an experienced coach based in Singapore and also the author of Inside Out Leadership, speaks about it here.
I mean, there are various techniques to reflect: meditation, journaling, positive affirmations, visualization, bunch of different ideas. But when we look at journaling, and it's quite true for meditation as well, but let's pick on journaling. The idea is that what we need to develop when we talk of developing self-awareness, we need to develop non-judgmental self-awareness. And why I say that? So for example, you recognize, you know, let's say you're journaling and you recognize routinely that you are, you know, lately you've been very irritable, or lately you've been feeling a bit down, or lately you've been a bit envious, whatever that feeling may be, right? Now, So that's a feeling that we want to become aware of, right? But the moment, what is our natural tendency though? You know, we all tend to judge ourselves because, and I'll come back to the point, we judge ourselves because there is a sense of incompleteness, inadequacy within us. And we are constantly trying to fill that void, and that's why we are judging, are we on track, are we not on track, and so forth. And it's that judgmental nature which forces us automatically to judge others as well, which we do all the time, including our, you know, loved ones, our kids, and so forth. And that makes things worse. So when we are talking about journaling or meditation and non-judgmental awareness, the idea is, so let's say you recognize that envy and the sadness and the irritability. If we judge it and we say, oh, you know, why do I feel like that? What's wrong with me? I'm not a good person. How could I be envious? Or I'm, you know, I talk about being a coach. How could I be feeling sad? I thought I was, you know, in the business of happiness, et cetera, et cetera. What do you think is going to happen to you? Do you think you're going to feel better or worse? Clearly, you're going to feel worse. And what you're doing is, you know, it's like your child, Deepak, who walks in and says, you know, hypothetically, oh, I'm in middle school and, you know, these two kids in my class, they are such bullies and they're so rude and this and the other and, you know, kids don't like me and all that kind of stuff. Now, what are you going to do? You want to reassure your child, right? You want to sit them down and say, no, it's okay. It's totally fine. You know, kids are kids and they do different things, but you are a wonderful person and you're so good in so many ways and so on and so forth. But when we are just thinking that, oh, I have been sad, we are not reassuring ourselves. We are actually making it worse. It's like telling the child that, oh yeah, how could you do that? How could people not like you? What's wrong with you? You know, I mean, that's just making it worse. So I think the starting point of all meditation and journaling and things like that is to create a non-judgmental space, because that is what is going to create greater self-acceptance, greater self-love. And all of that is actually automatically going to heal us from that void of the sense of inadequacy and incompleteness. Because we start to then accept ourselves for who we are. And it's okay. And that doesn't also mean, Deepak, because the other typical sort of challenge there is oh, if I'm being like that and everything is fine, then, you know, will I become complacent? And it's not that. We all have the drive to get better and we will keep getting better. But it's just that oftentimes we are trying to get better from a place of inadequacy. That only if I get better will I be complete. And my point is, no, you are already whole, complete and enough the way you are and where you are right now at this very instant, every single human being. And we want to get better. So that's the reason why this non-judgmental self-awareness is crucial. Because the judgmental part is the thinking mind which makes things worse. If we can subdue that, then slowly we become aware, yeah, I've been sad last few days, and that's okay. The sadness is going to pass. It will pass. Like every feeling. The excitement and the joy will also pass, and so will the sadness and the irritability. Both will pass if we don't engage with it.
For us to build non-judgmental self-awareness, it's critical for us to closely look at the prompt, which is often the jump-off point when we journal. Turns out, there's a nuance here. So the second point I want to make around how we journal is to be thoughtful about the journaling prompt and use a what prompt rather than a why prompt. Tasha Urich, author of the book Insight and one of the leading thinkers in the space of self-awareness, speaks about it here.
We surveyed about 300 people and we asked them, how much time do you spend introspecting? In other words, kind of pondering the deeper meaning behind our thoughts and our feelings and our motives. And then we surveyed them on things like, are you stressed? Are you depressed? Are you anxious? Are you happy? Do you like your job? Are you happy with your relationships? Do you feel in control of your life? And naturally, because self-awareness is good, I knew that we would find that the more people introspected, the better off they'd be. And that was the opposite of what our data showed. So we found that people who self-reflected often were more anxious, more stressed, more depressed, less satisfied with their jobs and their relationships. They were even less in control of their lives. And we're just sitting there going, oh my gosh, maybe self-awareness is bad, right? Maybe delusion is actually what we want to be fostering because this doesn't seem like it makes sense. And as we started to dig into some of the data, we started to discover that thankfully, it's not that introspection in and of itself is bad. It's just that the way most of us introspect is completely wrong. And the best way to illustrate this, you know, again, without having 2 hours to delve into it, is to think about probably what the most common introspective question is for most people, which is the question, why? So we might be trying to understand why we're in a bad mood. You know, you could say, why am I so upset after that conversation with my coworker? Or we might be trying to understand a bad outcome. You know, like, why didn't I get that promotion? Or we might be even trying to understand why we believe what we believe. You know, why do I want that promotion? But as it turns out, those questions, not only do they lead us away from true insight about ourselves, they give us a false sense of confidence about our knowledge. So, for example, Sigmund Freud was wrong. He believed in his work that people could access their unconscious, right? So like, really, why am I upset? If I just excavate, if I just think long and hard and ask that why question, I can find the answer. But what research has shown for decades, actually, is that no matter how hard we try, we can't access so many of those things. It's what I mentioned earlier about the behavior and emotion and knowledge blindness. Mm-hmm. So what happens is we find an answer that feels true, even if it's wrong. So that's an example of where it can lead us away from the truth rather than towards it. Another reason why is a really dangerous question, introspectively, is it has been shown over and over and over to depress us. You know, you think about it, like, why didn't I get that promotion? If you're not careful, you can start asking questions where the answers are, well, because I'm just a fundamentally bad person and who would want to promote me? And you can kind of get stuck in, I call it the rabbit hole of rumination. And so what we wanted to do in our study was understand, okay, if why is the wrong question, what is the right question? You know, what are these unicorns doing differently than the rest of us? And it took us a little while to find this pattern, but we discovered that when unicorns introspected, they almost never asked why questions. They asked what questions. And at first I thought like, oh, that's just a weird sort of fluke or a weird nuance. But as we started to look into it, it started to make a huge amount of sense. So one example would be, you know, going back to the question, why didn't I get that promotion? Unicorns, if they were in that situation, wouldn't ask themselves that question. Here's some questions they might have asked instead. What did I learn that can help me be better positioned in the future? Or what can I do to close the gap between, you know, where I thought I was and where I need to be? Or what support can I enlist from the people around me to help me, you know, achieve this goal the next time I set it? Or, you know, going back to why am I so upset about that conversation with my coworker? They might instead ask, well, what part of that situation did I own? Or what can I do differently in the future to avoid that kind of conversation with that person? And so what we found was asking what instead of why really helps us avoid so many of the pitfalls of introspection where we, you know, we're excavating for the truth that we're never going to find and we're focusing on our problems and feeling victimized and disempowered.
The key is to take a scientist's view towards journaling and focus on data, not bring in opinions. I was recently reading the book What to Make of a Life by Jim Collins, the author of bestsellers like Good to Great and Built to Last. Here, he researches many journeys and speaks about what it takes to lead a good life. In that, he speaks about his journaling practice and how it got him out of, to use his words, the fog in his life. Let's first see where Jim comes from. In mid-20s, Jim Collins was working at HP, Hewlett-Packard. On paper, it was a dream job, but Jim felt what he calls out of frame. He realized that he wasn't flourishing. So he decided to turn his workplace into a personal laboratory. He bought a standard lab notebook, the kind with the grid lines, and wrote Jim on the cover. But here's the interesting part. The title didn't mean that the book belonged to him. It meant the subject under study was a bug named Jim, to use his words. I guess the core philosophy of the bug book is to be a scientist of the self. Jim then went on to record this for a period of time, and then after some time took a step back to look at what was emerging. In social interactions, he noted his lack of political instinct and how he would accidentally offend people by pointing out logical inconsistencies in public. In terms of energy management, he observed that he had a natural capacity for creative work in the morning and a need for midday naps to create a second morning of productivity in the afternoon. In terms of interests versus obligations, he realized that he was deeply curious about company history, but utterly uninterested in the corporate career ladder. This wasn't just data collection for the sake of it. It led to an epiphany. Through his notes, Jim discovered his encoding, to use his words, the things he was hardwired to do were research and learn complex things, turn chaos into concepts, and build frameworks and teach for impact. This realization is what eventually led him to leave the corporate world and become the world-renowned researcher and author we know today. Jim is now 40 years into this practice. While the physical notebook has evolved into a systematic spreadsheet over time, daily habit remains. Every night, he tracks three specific things. One, time distribution, which is how he spent the day. Two, creative hours. He tracks these to ensure that he hits at least 1,000 creative hours every year. Three, quality score. He rates each day on a scale of +2 to -2. +2 is a great day, -2 is a horrible day. By doing this, he can look at correlations. What makes a +2 day? What patterns lead to a -2 day? This allows him to make adjustments to ensure more super positive days and fewer super negative ones. But the key insight here is that he collects the data for a period of time, for a few weeks or months, and then steps back and looks at what is emerging for him. He doesn't try to decode the patterns on a day-to-day basis. Jim says that when you try to analyze why you had a good day the same evening, you might think because you had a success somewhere or you accomplished something, you had a good day. But he goes on to say that when you collect the data and see the pattern after 90 days, after collecting all the plus twos and looking at the commentary around it, you might realize that there's something very different which is driving the great day. It might just be the fact that you slept very well the previous night and you were fully rested, something you may not account for or something you may not even realize on a day-to-day basis. Once again, Jim's approach is super detailed and specific, but you get the drift. You take what makes sense for you and build your practice. Just to go back to what Jim says about how he journaled when he was at HP, it turns out that there are two variables we can track for us to see if we are playing the right game or if we need to find a different canvas for us to play to our potential. During transitions, this can be truly powerful when we are trying to discern career direction. Something similar came up in my conversation with Bill Burnett. Bill is one of the founders of Design Your Life, a course that originated at Stanford and now a movement. He speaks about how we all can track energy and engagement.
Yeah, so energy would be, when we do a thing where you do an energy map of your week, like when you're doing activities, some activities you do, when you're done, you actually feel more energetic. Like, you know, this is a cool conversation. Mm-hmm. When we're done, I'm going to be full of ideas and you're going to be full of ideas. We'll be more energetic. Other times I have conversations maybe with toxic people in my organization about budgets and things, and it's a zero-sum game and they're always fighting. And that's just drains me of my energy. Okay, so energy is really a kind of a something you can notice in yourself. And the metric we use is when you're done with a task, are you more or less energetic than you were when you started? Mm-hmm. Engagement, turns out the human brain can only do one thing at a time. It can do lots and lots of things in parallel, but you're only aware of one thing at a time. So what you put your attention to, what you engage in, is where you're putting all your cycles. Are you engaging in lots of negative behaviors, negative self-talk, negative interactions with people? Are you engaged in positive self-talk, positive interactions, positive activities? Engagement is about what you spend your time on, and energy is really what's the energetic profile of those things. Are they giving or draining energy? So they are different. And, you know, I did this one because I've tried doing journaling. You know, I'm supposed to journal, it's supposed to be good for you, and all the positive psychologists say journaling is great. I just never could get into it. So I figured, all right, I could write one line a day, one line, one observation about my day, and I could put it on, we got two little dials on our Good Time Journal. Give me one thing that happened today that was positive, rate positive, negative energy, positive, negative engagement. And if it was flow, put a big red star. And that people can, you can persist in that because it's just one observation of a day, positive or negative, one observation a day. Rate it on the chart, move to the next day. Do that for the positive side guys will say, if you want to start a new habit or eliminate an old bad habit, it takes about 8 weeks. So journal for 6 to 8 weeks and see how your mood is, see how your feeling is. The more you spend time paying attention to positive things, guess what? More positive things show up. Huh. Mm. Isn't that funny?
Just to recap on the different perspectives on how to journal. Be non-judgmental, what rather than why, and adopt a scientific approach. Track energy and engagement, especially if you're at the cusp of a transition. While the approach that Jim suggests feels highly structured and regimented, there's also an approach where we can pick a provocation or a prompt depending on how we are doing, something that's a little more flexible and adaptable to our context. Now we bring back Rich Fernandez, who we heard from at the beginning of this episode.
What we like to encourage people to do is find the prompt that's most relevant for you at that point in time. So if you're feeling particularly frustrated during a certain period, write about things that annoy you so that you get clarity on those. If you're hoping for a new situation, think about what your work or life would be like if it exceeded your expectations in a year. And so that's one exercise I actually do at the beginning of every year. I do that exercise myself. If my life exceeded my expectations in the next 3 years, my life would ... and I just write that. I write that every year at the end of the year as I set up for the new year. So just think about situationally what would be a useful prompt for you and then just get going writing on it.
Before we wrap, a quick comment on the when of journaling. I've noticed that there are no right answers. Mornings at the beginning of the day are often useful because they set the tone for what is to follow. Very often I tell my coaches that journaling at the back end of some solitary pursuit, like a walk or a swim, is often useful. Because when you're doing these activities, your subconscious washing machine is often spinning. Journaling at the end of such an activity is equivalent of clearing the sediments after stirring a cup of water for a while. But I wouldn't overthink it. Find the space that feels natural in the rhythm of your day. The key point is it shouldn't feel like a chore, but it should be done when you're fully alive. I'm sure there are many other benefits and facets of journaling that we haven't explored in this conversation. But I hope it's given you a sense of the benefits of journaling and maybe some places where you can get started. In summary, I would say just the act of writing and putting pen on paper can do wonders in terms of putting you in touch with yourself and moving you forward. I hope some of the perspectives in this episode of Connecting the Dots give you a directional sense of how to go about journaling and how not to go about it. As I wrap, let me suggest one place where you can get started with journaling, something I referred to earlier in the episode. It's with the journal Crafting a Full Life that the Play to Potential team has carefully curated over the years. It has a luxury leather cover, custom stitching, and can be a great gift to yourself or your teams or your friends and family on a key occasion. The journal is all about deepening your self-awareness, systematically looking at various aspects of your life across work, family, health, relationships, and so on. It has 52 topics, and it's meant to be a year-long guide where I encourage you to spend a week on each topic. Every topic has a curated audio clip from the podcast archives, a quote that is relevant for the topic that's being discussed, and some journaling prompts for you to apply it to your life. You can find more details at playtopotential.com/journal. Do check it out. I hope you find it meaningful. Thank you for listening, and bye now.